Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. Today is Friday, October 28th, 2011. This is podcast number 43. And with it being Friday, it's been at least a week since I bashed any greenbackers, so I thought this would be a good time to bash a greenbacker. Well, not really. I'm just going to talk about free market money. What is free market money? Give a little idea of some of the history of free market money, and I have a special treat, a little Murray Rothbard to read for you today. But first, I want to mention if you didn't just hear it, we do have a very active and angry cat this morning wandering around in here, so you'll probably hear cat noises. But if you're a regular listener, you're used to hearing things like ringing bells and dogs barking and cats meowing and birds squawking and crickets crying. So back to my point. There is currently an act before Congress. It is called the Free Competition and Currency Act of 2011. It was introduced by Congressman Ron Paul, and it's numbered H.R. 1098. That's House Resolution 1098. A quick overview of this from GovTrack.us says, Free Competition and Currency Act of 2011 repeals the federal law establishing U.S. coins, currency, and reserve notes as legal tender for all debts, public charges, taxes, and dues. Prohibits any tax on any coin, metal, token, or gold, silver, platinum, palladium, or rhodium, bullion issued by a state, the United States, a foreign government, or any other person. Prohibits states from assessing any tax or fee on any currency or any other monetary instrument that is used in interstate or foreign commerce and that has legal tender status under the Constitution. Repeals provisions of the Federal Criminal Code relating to uttering coins of gold, silver, or other metal for use as current money and making or possessing likenesses of such coins, abates any current prosecution under such provisions, and nullifies any previous convictions. So that's Ron Paul's H.R. 1098. Of course, it has no chance. There's no possible way they're going to let that get through Congress. It would be cool if they did. From a liberty point of view, that would be a tremendous boost for our cause, for the economy, for general well-being of the financial condition of Americans. It would be tremendous. But it's not going to happen because that takes, as I've said before, money is the most powerful, the most important of the means of production. And this H.R. 1098 would remove money from the control of the state. It's currently in this weird marriage between the Federal Reserve, which is private, and the Treasury, which is, of course, the federal government. And this weird marriage between the two, fascism, is who controls the money supply currently, which means that the main means of production is controlled centrally. It's centrally planned. That's socialism. In the case that we currently have, where this marriage between a private banking institution and the government manages the money, then, of course, that type of socialism is called fascism. Of course, that's just a recap. Anybody that's been listening knows that I'm saying that just about every day here lately. Okay, so free competition in currency. Now, what would that mean? What would a free competition in currency look like, or what would that mean to us? Okay, well, I'm going to read for you just a little bit. It's not very much. From Murray Rothbard's book, A History of Money and Banking in the U.S. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not even reading it correctly. I'll read it the way Murray wrote it. A History of, if I could do a funny, high-pitched old-timey New York accent. Then I could read it the way Murray wrote it. But okay, so history of money and banking in the United States, the colonial area, the colonial. Oh boy, this is going to be a fun read, folks. Stick with me. The colonial era to World War II. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read one little section here. Let me get over to it. This is Chapter 1, Part 1, A History of Money and Banking in the United States Before the 20th Century. And as we begin the chapter here, I first have to zoom in because I can't read something that small. Let's get that bigger. Here comes the cat to bother us. There we go. A History of Money and Banking in the United States Before the 20th Century by Murray Rothbard. As an outpost of Great Britain, colonial America, of course, used British pounds, pence, and shillings as its money. Great Britain was officially on a silver standard, with the shilling defined as equal to 86 pure troy grains of silver, and with silver as so defined legal tender for all debts, that is, creditors were compelled to accept silver at that rate. However, Britain also coined gold and maintained a bimetallic standard by fixing the gold guinea weight 129.4 grams of gold as equal in value to a certain weight of silver. In that way, gold became, in effect, legal tender as well. Unfortunately, by establishing Britain became perpetually subject to the evil known as Gresham's Law, which states that when government compulsorily overvalues one money and undervalues another, the undervalued money will leave the country or disappear into hoards, while the overvalued money will flood into circulation. Hence the popular catchphrase of Gresham's Law, bad money drives out good. But the important point to note is that the triumph of bad money is the result not of perverse free market competition, but of government using the compulsory legal tender power to privilege one money above another. In 17th and 18th century Britain, the government maintained a mint ratio between gold and silver that consistently overvalued gold and undervalued silver in relation to world market prices, with the resultant disappearance and outflow of full-bodied silver coins and an influx of gold, and the maintenance in circulation of only eroded and lightweight silver coins. Attempts to rectify the fixed bimetallic ratios were always too little and too late. In the sparsely settled American colonies, money, as it always does, arose in the market as a useful and scarce commodity and began to serve as a general medium of exchange. Thus, beaver, fur, and wampum were used as money in the North for exchanges with the Indians, and fish and corn also served as money. Rice was used as money in South Carolina, and the most widespread use of commodity money was tobacco, which served as money in Virginia. The pound of tobacco was the currency unit in Virginia, with warehouses accepting tobacco circulating. With warehouse receipts in tobacco circulating as money backed 100% by the tobacco in the warehouse. While commodity money continued to serve satisfactorily in rural areas, as the colonial economy grew, Americans imported gold and silver coins to serve as monetary media in urban centers and in foreign trade. English coins were imported, but so too were gold and silver coins from other European countries. Among the gold coins circulating in America were the French guinea, the Portuguese joe, the Spanish doubloon, and Brazilian coins, while silver coins included French coins and livres. It is important to realize that gold and silver are international commodities, and that, therefore, when not prohibited by government decree, foreign coins are perfectly capable of serving as standard monies. There's no need to have a national government monopolize the coinage, and indeed, foreign gold and silver coins constituted much of the coinage in the United States until Congress outlawed the use of foreign coins in 1857. Thus, if a free market is allowed to prevail in a country, foreign coins will circulate naturally. Silver and gold coins will tend to be valued in proportion to their respective weights, and the ratio between silver and gold will be set by the market in accordance with their relative supply and demand. Now, the purpose in reading that, again, this is Murray Rothbard's History of Money and Banking in the United States. The reason that I read that, before I go into that, let me just point out that this book by Murray Rothbard, if you turn to the back of it and you see the documentation, he's not just whipping this off the top of his head. He's not just describing a fantasy that he's hoping that we'll believe in, or a fantasy that he just puts faith in that used to be a certain way. Murray Rothbard, in addition to being an economist, was also one of the best historians that we had in the 20th century. If you go into the footnotes in this book and you go through all the references, he more than covers all the facts required to prove every single word that he says is true. This is how money was done in the colonies and in the United States for the first, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, the first 90 years of the United States and during the colonial period prior to that, we had a free market in money. Now, it is true that there was on and off central banks. Of course, we know that Hamilton set one up and Jackson tore it down, and we know about the struggles that went back and forth between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, and there was this struggle between those pro-banking groups and those wanting a smaller, less government. But above and beyond that, until 1857, in the United States, free market money was legal. After 1857, free market money was against the law in the United States. So what does that mean for us in regards to greenbackers? Again, let me run over for you what greenbackers are. Greenbackers roughly came into existence about the same time that law was put into effect, because they had a major influence in getting that law enacted. Their whole purpose at that time, as now, is for Congress and Congress only to control what is money and how much money that there is. They would go with a 100% fiat money based strictly on Congress's word. Essentially, that's it. They just would create the money by the will of Congress. They create as much as they want. They create it whenever they want, and they do whatever they want to with it when they create it. To me, that is a leap of faith to trust those people in Congress. That's beyond understanding as to why anyone would want to take that position. But that is the position. And then one of the little odd characteristics is that they want to outlaw, of course they want to outlaw fractional reserve banking, and they want to outlaw the Federal Reserve, and they want to outlaw central banking, but they also want to outlaw certain types of interest, and different ones of the greenbackers take a slightly different position on this one way or the other, so I'm not even going to really focus on that too much. But the real focus is who controls the supply of money, who controls the means of production, the specific means of production that is the money supply. Now, if you think of means of production, the means of production could be, let's say, the iron ore supply. If all of a sudden the government was to say, and governments do these kind of things, so this is not that unusual. If the government was to say, all iron ore reserves now belong to the government. Now, if you think that'd be crazy for them to do that, well, governments regularly do that with oil supplies, even the oil that's not yet pulled out of the ground yet. Governments regularly do that. Well, the United States government did that with helium in the 1930s. The United States government nationalized all helium in the 1930s, and their purpose was so that helium couldn't be sold to Germany to be used in their Zeppelins, which forced Germany to use the highly flammable hydrogen in their Zeppelins, and we know how that went. Okay, so when the government seizes a commodity, whatever that commodity might be, and then the government decides how much of that commodity goes onto the market and who gets paid for it and how those exchanges take place, the word for that is socialism. Whether that commodity is iron or whether that commodity is oil or whether that commodity is helium, whatever the commodity is, that part of the means of production, if the government controls it, then the government controls that part of the means of production, and it's socialism. And money is a means of production. Another means of production is in farming, corn. The government controls the corn supply by subsidizing and guaranteeing certain prices, and by fixing the market price and fixing the exchange rate and the overseas sales and the import rates and the export fees. By manipulating all these aspects of the production of corn, the government controls the production of corn. So again, all industrialized farming in the U.S. faces one level or another of these government interferences in their aspect of the market. Therefore, it's socialism. Many parts of it are actually fascism, as in the corn subsidies and the sugar subsidies and the rice subsidies and the restrictions involving cotton, and there's a whole variety of these things. Another thing that's means of production that the government of the United States has seized is water. Now we think, okay, well, if I just drill a hole in my backyard, I can get water. How the government can't control that? Well, yes and no. It's according to where you're at. In some places, the government owns the water under your house that's in the earth. In some places, the government owns the water that's falling out of the sky. In the West, there are places where the government, usually state or local governments, but it's all the same. I mean, the state is the state. But the government owns the rain that's actually falling from the sky, and if you capture it, you're stealing the government's water. You can get in trouble for that. And that varies from place to place in the West. As goofy as that may sound, that's the law. And that's the government managing or central planning the means of production. That's what we call socialism. If you look up socialism, you will see that socialism is the central or communal control of the means of production. Now, that can be through a committee, that can be through a government, that can be through a state, that can be through a bunch of guys with guns. Well, I guess that would be the state, wouldn't it? Okay, so the money supply is the means of production, is the major means of production, and if the state owns the money supply, if the state controls the money supply, then it's socialism. Now, the problem with that is, as Mises so pointed out, why didn't I have Mises up here? I read Rothbard, why didn't I read Mises? What Mises thoroughly and completely shows is that when socialism takes place, you cannot determine the price in a socialist economy. The price of anything is distorted, and you cannot determine the price. And if you can't determine the supply, the demand. You can't determine the demand, and you can't determine the price. You can't determine the demand because there is no price mechanism. So you end up either overproducing or you end up underproducing. And as you overproduce, you have gluts on the market. You have, or in some cases, booms. It's according to what's being produced. In the case of money, you have booms. That's what causes a boom in the economy, is this too much of something being produced, and so you get a boom, and that boom results in the guaranteed bust. So whatever it is that the state is centrally planning, the state has no mechanism to determine how much production should take place. So it always either overproduces or underproduces. Overproducing produces a boom. Underproducing causes shortages. For a little bit of history on that, take a look at the Ukraine and see what the Soviet Union did to the people, to the farmers in the Ukraine, as they underproduced and overproduced, and they ended up starving millions of people in the Ukraine, specifically because of this. Now, when the government controls the money supply, then you have these oversupplies and undersupplies of money. Now, so you say, well, how could the market do all these things? The market, in a free market money system, it's just like a free market in potatoes, or a free market in chewing gum, or a free market in, propeller beanie hats, free market in pop rocks. It doesn't matter what it is. The market itself determines the demand. How do you know that the market's going to determine the demand? Because the market is the demand. The market determines the demand. The market determines the price. The market then produces to fill the demand at that price. So when the market is left alone, when the market is free, then the market determines the supply, the demand, the price, the production, all these things are done. That's what Adam Smith called the invisible hand, because it seems like someone is doing it, but there's no one there. It does it on its own. It's self-managed. But when the government comes in and starts trying to fiddle with that, then the tune goes way off, you see. And that's why socialism can't work. That's what Mises spent his lifetime just going over and over, showing in different ways that this is the case. This is why socialism won't work. This is why the Soviet Union was doomed to fall. This is why any socialist economy cannot self-support. If you look at China right now, you say, well, China's doing pretty good. China's having a lot more trouble than we in the United States see. And China has taken on huge segments of a market economy rather than a socialist economy. And that's the saving grace for China at the moment. But as it wanders back and forth between a market economy and a socialist economy, China is bound to crash. I mean, it's just a guaranteed thing. It's just that when you're robbing, you can continue. A socialist government can continue to rob as long as there's someone to rob. But once they hit the fence and there's nothing else to rob, then they eat themselves and collapse on themselves. That's what happened to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union expanded to a certain point, and then it robbed as much as it could rob, and then it couldn't go out and rob anymore, and it fell in on itself. This is what's going to happen to the United States of America, to the government of the United States of America. The government of the United States of America is on the same fast track as the Soviet Union, or as any other fascist or Soviet-style or socialist government throughout history has done. They are using up their resources. Their resources are the wealth of the people, and the wealth of the people is very dramatically being siphoned away into the pockets of the banks and of government and and foreigners too. It's being pulled out of our pockets and sent away to places like China. China's economy is doing fairly well because they're pulling wealth out of our economy. And the reason why is because we have a centrally controlled means of production in cash. So, again, what will happen if Ron Paul's resolution were to actually pass? What would happen? Well, money would become legal. All money would become legal, not just Federal Reserve notes. All money, like it was prior to 1857. Okay, so for instance, if you go to the 1849, to the California Gold Rush, there were the following things were money in California: Spanish coins, Mexican coins, French coins. There were actually a variety of, there were Dutch coins floating around. English coins were floating around in California. U.S. coins were floating around in California. In addition to all those things being money, actual gold was money. Gold dust, gold nuggets, gold bullion was money. The same way with silver, although silver wasn't as common as was gold, but there were active silver mines, and there was silver in the West. In addition to all that, another thing that was money, oddly enough, is eggs. Eggs were money in Sacramento. At one point in time, eggs were valued almost pound for pound more than gold. The point in that being that the market figures out what money is. Just like in Virginia, when tobacco and tobacco certificates became gold. So, for instance, Baggy, stop it. I'm going to throw something at you. I will. It's possible in some communities a local resource would become a local money, a local form of exchange. Perhaps we'll assume no government interference in corn subsidies, but of course that's there. But just for the sake of the discussion, let's assume that there were no corn subsidies and the government didn't interfere in the corn market. So let's say you're in the middle of Ohio, and you would like to you have a nice field of corn. And you have plenty of corn in your silos, and you need tractor tires. Well, it's possible that the guy at the tire shop may take corn for your tires. And you think, well, this is a barter economy. Not really. Not if, in a local sense, if corn becomes a cash, a commodity. Well, it already is a commodity. If we're allowed to exchange it as money. Then within one corn-based community, you could maintain a lot of the wealth that's in that community while bringing in more as you export, like corn. So you're bringing in money in hard money like gold or silver or whatever into the community as you sell corn out of it. But as you're producing corn within the community and exchanging it among yourselves, you're not sending out gold or silver. You see, so locally, if you're producing something and you're also using that commodity as money, you'll be sending out product. And you'll be bringing in gold and silver while not sending out as much gold and silver, because you're not, you know, all of a sudden you're buying a tire with corn. Well, as this exchange takes place among a larger group of people, maybe in the neighboring community they don't recognize corn. So that's fine. So take gold or silver when you go over there, or take, Canadian coins, or take U.S. coins, because there's nothing within this bill that keeps the U.S. from continuing to make coins. See, that's the thing about a free market, as opposed to socialism. Socialism always requires the gun to be stuck in your face. Always. Because in a free market situation, if socialism existed side by side with a true free market, then over time, the majority of people would choose the free market and the socialism would just dissolve and go away. So the only way the socialism has a chance at existing is through robbery of those in the free market. And generally, those people in the free market don't appreciate that, and they resist. So let's say Ron Paul's bill goes through, there's nothing within that bill to keep the federal governments from still producing, you know, whatever they want. They could produce Federal Reserve notes if they can get somebody to take them. They could, the Treasury could still produce coins, they could produce quarters, they could produce dimes, they could produce dollars, they could produce $20 coins. The trick is, if they continue like they are today, making them out of junk metal instead of actual silver and gold, then the odds are nobody'd want the junk metal. I mean, it's only really worth its melt value anyway. So if on the market there's junk money and there's good money and there's no government force involved. This is what Murray was talking about in there with how the exchange rate in England was messed up because the government forced it. The government used the force of government to modify the exchange rate, therefore causing silver to go out of the country and causing gold to come into the country. Now, they did that on purpose. And they made attempts to correct it, but of course, we know better. It was really a way for the government to loot the people using the devaluation of the metal. So this is the thing of it. Whenever there is true competition, the good money will push the bad money out. But according to Gresham's law, if the force of government is there, then it's the other way around. The force of government causes the bad money to stay in circulation, and the good money will go to foreign countries, or it will go into hoards, and people will hide it and stash it away. As it's happening right now, that's what's happening right now in America. The junk money is what's being used. Junk money is being poured on us by the Federal Reserve. And real money is being pushed out either into hoards or into China or into India or into other places that are actually buying gold. That's what's currently happening now. So if we switch that to Congress controlling, then yes, we get rid of this problem of fractional reserve banking. That's good. We get rid of the production of fiat money through credit expansion. That's good. But you still have Congress in control of the money. You still have socialist money. You still have the bad money driving out the good money. So you still have a flow of wealth out of the U.S., and you have all the good money being hoarded or else going to China and India and Russia and Brazil and other countries that are behaving smarter than the U.S. government is. Now, I can put my little conspiracy theory hat on and I can say, and there's a reason for that. It's because America has a lot of wealth right now, and those who are in control want to take that wealth. And how do they do that? Through junk money. That's one of the major ways that they do it, and they have now for 100 years. They've really been doing it since 1857 to a lesser extent. But when the Federal Reserve was created, they did it to a large extent. Now, keep in mind, in 1857, that was right before Lincoln took office, 3 years before Lincoln became president, and the first thing Lincoln did was to start enacting greenback policies. He started issuing Congress-issued greenbacks. That's where the greenbackers got their name. Much of the wealth of the country was pulled away at that time in the 1860s and into the hands of bankers and into the hands of the government and into the hands of the railroad companies and the timber companies. These guys cashed in big as the wealth was pulled out of the pockets of America. Now in 1870, there was some lightning. I don't think it was the exact year of 1870. I'd have to look. Robert Higgs does a bunch of stuff on this, and I don't have it in front of me. But in the 1870s, that stranglehold on the cash lightened, and due to the explosion of the Industrial Revolution and all the increase in jobs and the increase in immigration that came into the United States, it was more than the looting could keep up with. And so we had basically a boom in the economy from about 1870. All, even though they say there were crashes, that's not true. It's just not true. Murray Rothbard has shown that to be the case, that there was no crash in the 1870s. Robert Higgs has shown that to be the case, and a variety of others have as well. So throughout those years, all the way until 1913, a tremendous amount of wealth built up in the United States. It was building up faster than Congress could steal it. But then the Federal Reserve was created, and we went then into, the ability to rip us off got even more dramatic. So I'll give the greenbackers this. If you have two people in front of you, both of which are planning on robbing you, and the person on the left that we're going to call the Fed is going to rob you at a rate of 500 robberies per second, and the guy on the right, Congress, is going to rob you at 460 robberies per second, then yes, having Congress rob you is slightly less painful than having the Fed rob you. Okay, so I'll give the greenbackers that. But a free market would mean neither of them can rob you, and you keep the money. And instead of having inflation, this is what you have in free market, with free market money, rather than having inflation where your money is constantly worth less and less and less, in a free market, the money is constantly worth more and more and more. Now, that's what happened in the 1800s. That's what Robert Higgs shows very successfully in his book that we plugged the other day when he was on the interview with us, with me here. So free market money actually is the opposite of inflation. Money becomes worth more and more and more. Your wages continually go up, but the money is also worth more. So like Bob Higgs said when... was that in the interview, or was that in his other piece that I was listening to today? I think that was in a different lecture that he gave that I was listening to today, that he said that within just a few years, the income level doubled in the U.S., the average income level doubled. And not only did it double, but the money was worth more at the end of that period. And so instead of prices constantly going higher and higher and your money worth less and less, it's the other way around. So when you save money, you save a dollar's worth today. 2 years from now, it's worth, even if you don't put it in the bank, it's worth more than when you stashed it. So it's like if money gains interest even without being in a bank. And then if you have honest banking, and you put that money in a bank, rather than earning 0.5% or something, you're going to earn better interest, whatever the market will drive. Maybe that's 5%, maybe it's 15%, who knows? As a matter of fact, it might change according to how much you have in the bank. No one can guess what a free market banking would look like today, but we know it would be better than a socialist banking, which is what we have. Okay. Baggy the Cat's telling me it's time to wrap it up, so I appreciate you listening. Be sure and check back with badquaker.com for more on greenbackers? No, probably not. I probably won't continue bashing the greenbackers every week. But for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And folks, thanks again for listening. I really appreciate, we're having more and more listeners just almost daily. Our number of listeners is going up. And I just want to thank you. I know that the listeners have got to be telling people there's only so many ways that the word can get out about badquaker.com. So I appreciate that the listeners are sharing the podcast and sharing the website. And thank you very much for listening, folks.